podcast at the cinema.
Hello, husband and co-host Alonzo Duralde.
Hello, husband and co-host Dave Weitz.
I feel like we haven't done a podcast in weeks or something.
It's been a kooky schedule. Outfest just ended, and you know that tends to eat my life while it's happening.
I mean, I know we did one yesterday.
Yes.
But that wasn't this one. It was the other one, and it was usually not the one that people hear who are Patreon people.
It was, yes. We did an LKTV yesterday with the cast of the Deck the Hallmark podcast.
The original Broadway cast.
Yes.
Of the Deck the Hallmark podcast.
They started on the West End and then brought it to New York. We did an LKTV, which is normally exclusive to our Patreon subscribers, but you know, we wanted to share the fun and the wealth and the whatever, so we made that one public. But we haven't done an actual, you know, our bread and butter Linoleum Knife, a podcast of the cinema, in a minute,
in about 8 or 9 days,
something like that. Yeah.
Who are you? What do you do for a living? I mean, I know your name.
As mentioned, I'm Alonzo Duralde. I'm the film reviews editor at The Wrap. I'm co-host of the Breakfast All Day podcast, as well as Who Shot Ya over at Maximum Fun. And this month, most notably, I'm a senior programmer at Outfest, which is why
until the end of this month,
I had about 10 days there where it was, really,
and then you're fired.
It was hard to sit down to do a podcast.
Sacked.
My seasonal employment will conclude. Thank you very much. Who are you, Dave White?
Film critic. That's it. Tea enthusiast. I read an article yesterday about the difference between PG tips and berries. Now, I've never had berries.
Oh, I thought you meant berries. I'm like,
I've heard of berries.
I've never seen them.
But it's even less available in the United States than PG tips. Like, PG tips can be found
PG
here and there.
PG tips got on a truck somewhere because I see them in, like, grocery stores that don't otherwise have, like, schmancy importy things. Like, someone's distributing.
Is not schmancy, though.
Well, I'm just saying, somebody,
it's the run of the milliest
tea that there is. But it is still an import. I'm saying PG tips found a U.S. distributor, berries.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever
they did.
Apparently
somehow
did not.
Yes.
So what's berries? It's
another black tea, and everyone says in this article anyway.
Everyone
in this article that is probably paid for by Berry's tea. I don't know.
Berries,
like the great debate between berries and PG tips, and now I have to try it. What if I haven't been living the
best tea life?
What if I haven't?
But if it turns out you like berries and you can't find it anywhere, what's the point?
You know what? I have my ways to get tea.
Oh, great. So you'll start spending more money to get it, you know,
you
flown
know
in,
you
flown in your
do.
Diplomatic
Listen,
attaché case.
I have a network of connections.
That's true.
Throughout the European continent.
You're right.
Whether
or not the United Kingdom remains a part of it.
Of all manner of things.
Fine.
So you just leave that to me.
And it's like, you know, our friend Robert one time came back from England with a jar of, with a bottle of Daddy's sauce that I thought was a tasty brown sauce. But all you can find in the United States is HP.
HP. And it's
about the same.
They're not far apart from each other.
Well, perhaps neither are berries and
I'm going to find out.
All right.
I will find out. Someone in this city carries it.
Not Monsieur Marcel.
We don't know. I haven't noticed.
I think it would have leapt out at you at this
point. No, because I'm always just looking for PG tips.
Fair enough.
Listen, I have...
All right, the search continues.
I will... So anyway, we are... today on the Linoleum Knife Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
And on Patreon. I'm going to set up... I'm going to post our recording schedule for this week.
Okay.
Each day, which show you're going to get.
Right.
Because there were no shows last week. None. Mm-hmm. We did nothing last week because you were always gone to Outfest stuff, and often quite unexpectedly.
Yes.
Times we thought we were going to record Outfest would call you and say, hey, can you come and blah, blah, blah. And you'd be like, okay, yeah, sure. I'm here. I'm off to go blah, blah, blah. So.
So much blah, blah, blah.
You did. And so we are currently, the shows you are now hearing are the ones we're recording to make up for last week. But then we're going to get right back into it.
And back on this week's.
Yeah,
back
so you're going to get like a show a day for the next 7 days.
If you're a Patreon subscriber,
if you're a Patreon person, of course. We'll
gird
tell you all
those
about
loins,
that later.
Everyone.
We got a funny message from a listener, Rowan,
in Australia,
who says that he has enjoyed the shows recently, but that he has now reached saturation point with Christians as guests.
We talked to the Deck the Hallmark guys about, like, you know, some faith-based television, among other topics.
The Deck the Hallmark guys, all three of them, Christians.
I
think we might have been the first people to say, all right, tell us your deal.
Yeah, no, like, it's not a thing they really get into on their show, but they were very happy to talk about
it. They don't get into it, but, like, for the past 3 months, listening to it with you, in the kitchen or the car, I'm like, who are these guys? Where do they come from? What's their background? What's going on? I'm hearing words.
You get clues, I know.
I'm hearing words that I only hear from Christians.
Right.
Right? But I didn't have... I needed to...
You wanted the full scale.
Listen, I had to go Detective Pikachu on this and find out what I needed to know.
And then a couple of weeks ago, we had Kevin and Caroline.
Good news, though.
Yes.
They're the kind of Christians that you like.
Yes! I knew this from the get-go, but you needed confirmation, and now you have it, so that's good. And then a couple of weeks ago, we had Kevin and Caroline from the Good Christian Fun podcast on to talk about Spider-Man.
And those two are going straight to hell, so I don't think they count.
Anyway, so yes, Rowan, not to worry. We are not...
From now on, we're going to give equal time to Satan... And I don't know who else.
Yeah. But not to worry.
But if there are any film-related representatives of Satan who want to come on this show, drop us a line.
Maybe next time there's an exorcism drama, which should be like 2 weeks, 3 weeks tops.
We love all and serve all.
Indeed.
Yeah. I guess that's every, those are my two announcements.
Okay.
Yeah. We have two movies to talk about this week. Should we start with the smaller one?
Yes. Because you haven't seen it.
Do the bigger one.
Yes.
And then chop the big one in half so that we can spoil it.
Yeah, we really have to do that with the big one this week. So anyway, the smaller movie this week is Kathy Griffin, : A Hell of a Story, which is screening this Wednesday night, tomorrow night, if you're listening to this podcast the day that it drops, July 31st, as a Fathom event nationwide. That is not to say that there won't be other opportunities to see it. I'm sure it's going to get some kind of release. Obviously, it's going to...
It'll get streamed
It'll be streaming and, you know, maybe Bravo broadcast
probably
later.
Probably won't carry
Probably
it.
Not Bravo or CNN. But it is a Kathy Griffin concert film, which in itself is already, like... pure pleasure. Mm-hmm. But there is a really great sort of intro documentary about all the what she calls the Trump wood chipper.
This is her Shut Up and Sing.
Kind of.
The documentary that went out, that was released about the Dixie Chicks and all of their troubles.
Yeah. Although she says, I didn't get Dixie chicked. I got Dixie rhymes with chicked. So you may recall that in, I believe, May of 2017, Kathy was doing a photo shoot, and one of the photos that they did was a picture of her holding up a Trump mask with ketchup on it as though it were his bloody head.
Full Caravaggio.
Yes, yes. And she even says in the film that later Hillary Clinton says, well, obviously you were referring to, you know, Medusa and whatever that painting is. Yeah. And she was like, gah! Why didn't I have that in my quiver from the get-go?
The minute I saw it.
I know, that was my first thought, too.
The minute I saw it.
But as Kathy says, I didn't go to college. I started working when I was 15. Anyway, so, you know, it got leaked by TMZ. And, of course, Harvey Levin at TMZ is totally, like, you know, up Trump's business,
yeah,
and,
I know.
Is a self-loathing gay Republican.
Right.
And So, you know, the ish hit the fan, and, you know, death threats and condemnations from the right, condemnations from the left, you know, Anderson Cooper dumping her as his co-host.
Former friend.
Former friend. Yeah, yeah. You know, in a very callow manner.
And former friend Andy Cohen.
Former friend Andy Cohen throwing her under the bus.
Two of them.
And then
treacherous gays.
And then, you know, she
and
was
not the kind I like. Either.
She was told to apologize, and in the film she basically says, she goes, I was apologizing essentially for an audience of one, which was Daniel Pearl's mother, you know, the journalist that was beheaded in Pakistan. But then that apparently like made a bunch of her fellow comedians, you know, get mad at her and turn their back on her. So like she doesn't name.
She won't name them.
She's cagey about naming them. Mm. But she does talk about the comedians who sort of stepped up and were supportive. Like Jim Carrey, apparently, who she'd never met, you know, like calls her up and she's like, you know, sobbing and talking about like, oh, my career's over, blah, blah, blah. And he basically tells her, today, you are the most famous comedian in the world.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyway, so you know, she goes on a tour basically of other, like she was in the middle of a US tour, which all the dates get canceled.
All of them got canceled.
So then she's like, "All right, fine. I'm going to tour the world and go to countries that hate Trump." And so she hits like, you know, 34 cities and, you know.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But of course, because the Justice Department is after her.
Yes.
You know, she gets stopped at
everywhere.
Airport.
Yeah,
take her passport, they take her phone, the whole thing. You know, and like that you just see the grind on her of like,
yep.
You know, this orchestrated attack. And she talked a lot in the film about how, like, I'm mainly telling all of this because it can happen to you.
Yes.
It could, you know, there is a mechanism in place to silence people, especially if they're women.
Yes.
And they're easy targets.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, male comedians would never be subject to the same crap that she got put through.
Right.
You know, they'd be like, oh, controversial, and then, you know, move on.
Right.
So, you know, the original sort of the opening, like, I don't know how long it is, but it gives a kind of a context to all the stuff that's happening, brings you up to speed on what's happening, and then you get the show. And I think the original show was like 3 hours long, and I would have happily sat through it, but, you know, you get like a standard kind of comedy movie length thing. And, you know, she is firing on all cylinders, you know, and here's somebody who's always been like sharp and funny and knows how to work a crowd and gets the timing and all that stuff when talking about utter frivolity.
Yeah.
And so now she's actually talking about this really important, serious.
She's always been very political.
I'm not implying that she isn't.
And has not often had it in her act.
Yeah.
You get her on a talk show couch, though, and she goes off.
Sure.
All the time.
And not to worry, if you wanted to hear her talk about the Kardashians, they come up. You know, there are some.
Well, they had better.
Well, you know, because she was living next door to Kim and Kanye for a while.
I did not know that.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
So that comes up. Anyway, so it's, if you are a fan of hers, like, you know, she and I don't agree on everything, like, say, who we're backing in 2020, but whatever, you know, that doesn't come up.
Does she say who she's for in 2020?
No, it comes up on Twitter a lot.
Who's she for in 2020?
Well, I know who she's not for.
Who's she not for?
The person I'm for.
Oh, I see. are we being cagey now about this?
I don't want to get into it.
Okay.
Not until 2020.
All right.
As, you know, we declared a moratorium.
Fine.
Anyway, but whatever. We don't
Full
have
communism,
to,
please.
Yes. We don't have to agree on everything. She is a hero, I think, really, for what she's had to endure. They wanted to make her a martyr, and she is instead a First Amendment warrior. And so, you know, joke's on you, right wing. Like, she has the literal last laugh in this. And I'm sure, like, there will always be career repercussions over all this stuff. But nonetheless, like, you know, she did that tour of Europe, came back to the States.
She's not going to get booked onto Chuck Norris's Variety
Hour. But, like, you know, she comes back from Europe and, you know,
or any Kirk Cameron joint.
No, definitely not.
Yeah.
I know she's very crushed about that. But, like, she sold out Carnegie Hall and, like, had this then really triumphant sort of return to the States.
Yeah.
So she played it all very well. And even though it was at a physical and emotional toll, she, you know, nevertheless, she persisted.
Right.
So it's an interesting movie if you like Kathy and you like comedy and you are interested in politics in this current day and age, you should check out Kathy Griffin, A Hell of a Story, which is, like I said, it's going to be a Fathom event on the 31st and then I'm sure available elsewhere.
I like her very much and I am interested.
Cool.
I'm not going to Fathom events on Wednesday night, well, but...
I'll tell you, here's the thing.
Eventually, it's going to be somewhere...
In your living room.
In my living room. Yeah.
I mean, and I'll say this, like, if you...
I would go see it if it were theatrically released. I would go buy a ticket to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
If you don't go to Fathom events because you are persnickety about, like, you know, the video quality or the...
You know,
the,
it ain't that bad because I go to the opera.
I was going to say...
Go to the Fathom operas and they're not... It's not bad. It's pretty good.
It's better than it used to be. And, like, you know, I went to see Die Hard when they did it and, you know, because... Ben mentioned me on the closing thing.
Yes,
and,
I know.
And it looked good, too, because, you know, all projection is digital now anyway. Like, unless you're going to the New Beverly, odds are you are seeing a movie that is digitally projected and not in 35. So,
oh, you mean the Dirty Movie Theater? They have premieres at the Dirty Movie Theater? I didn't know that.
Oh, that's the New Beverly. Oh, okay.
What did you think she was talking about?
I forgot, because they were at the El Coyote, of course.
There's
a
scene.
There's
a scene near the end of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood where Margot Robbie, as I'm going to lose my mind about this garbage truck
beeping, I know, really.
Outside. Should we just, let's stop.
Okay, we'll pause until they... I didn't even pause. You said it, and you, Dave, you sent your manifestation to the universe?
The universe listened to me for the first, oh no, the universe is trolling me now. Doesn't matter, they moved away.
They're driving
up the street. Okay, so.
There's a scene in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood
where you see Sharon Tate's final night, and she goes to eat at El Coyote on Beverly.
Which is still there.
Which is four blocks down the street. From the New Beverly. Now, the New Beverly is an old movie theater in Los Angeles. Formerly a first-run theater back in the olden times.
Yeah.
Fell into disrepair. Became a porn theater. And then it went dormant. And then it became a repertory cinema, which then became owned by, and is still currently owned by, and often programmed by, Quentin Tarantino.
Yes. But before we get to...
She alludes to it.
Yes.
It's a sort of wink.
I did not make that connection.
It's a wink to the people who live in Los Angeles and who know exactly where
the geography
things are on Beverly Boulevard.
And who owns that theater.
And who owns that theater.
Before we talk about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, though, this episode is brought to you by a sponsor. And we'll tell you about it as soon as this damn garbage truck goes away. Okay, 5 years have passed.
We're much older now.
We have long white beards.
I'd get all the discounts on my AARP card.
But dang
my
it.
My pension is about to kick in.
But dang nabbit, that garbage truck is gone.
Guess what?
What?
I'm excited.
I can tell by the inflection of your voice.
We have a sponsor.
We do.
I'm very excited. This is an actual advertiser, you guys.
Woo.
On our teeny tiny little fingerling potato podcast. We are excited to introduce to you Ovid.tv.
That's O, V as in Victor, I, D as in David. You know, like the guy who wrote the Metamorphoses.
The Roman poet of olden times during the reign of Augustus.
I translated...
Contemporary of Virgil and Horace.
Okay, now you're just reading the Wikipedia page. I actually did translate part of the Metamorphoses in 8th grade Latin, but I remember none of it.
Did you, Alonso, did you take a Latin class?
What, do I mention that a lot or something?
In our personal life.
Okay, well, the show doesn't know.
You're like, oh, in Latin, I blah, blah, blah. It's like, I prepped a choked. Like, this is how you...
I did not.
This is how you talk.
Yes, all the time. through my Connecticut lockjaw.
We have actually mentioned Ovid before because we have it on our Apple TV, and we love it very much.
Yes.
It is a new streaming service for art house films.
Yay.
International cinema, documentaries. Described by the New York Times as a haven for indie gems. Ovid TV features films such as Claire Denis' Trouble Every Day.
Oh.
Oh, you don't want to watch Trouble Every Day.
Yes.
I love Trouble Every Day.
I have a sensitive
constitution. You don't want to watch Trouble Every Day.
Yes. I know my limits.
Deborah Granick's Stray Dog.
All right.
And Raul Ruiz's Time Regained. Actually, you know what? I have another whole list of great films that are on there right now.
Other great films.
That I have seen and love very much. Some of them I saw before we got Ovid, but some of them I've seen on Ovid since we got it. And actually I wrote down Trouble Every Day before I even looked at that copy. Wong Bing's Dead Souls from last year, that 10-hour documentary.
Yes.
His other documentary, Three Sisters, Happy Hour.
Ooh, yes.
The film we cannot stop talking about.
Yes.
That we've mentioned many times by, Ryusuke Hamaguchi. And whose new film Asako 1 and 2 is finally coming to Los Angeles for like a week or so soon in August, I think.
Yeah, that was the movie where all the New York critics, when they were doing their top films of 2019 so far, listed that. I was like, we didn't get it yet.
Yeah. Do You Wonder Who Fired the Gun?
Oh, yeah.
That I talked about at the end of last year. Is on there. Our Daily Bread, Nicholas Gerwalter's
gorgeous sort of
industrial food documentary.
Yeah, but like wordless and haunting.
Yeah. So much wonderful stuff is on Ovid.
If you're worried that, you know, they took Friends off of Netflix, like, relax. There's other good stuff on streaming.
Friends is not on Ovid.
No.
As a special introductory offer, for Linoleum Knife listeners, you will save 50% off your first 3 months of subscription. You go over to www.ovid.tv. Sign up with the coupon code PODCAST. And you'll get Ovid TV for $3.50 per month for 3 months. This offer expires August 31st.
Oh, chop chop.
So if you're one of those people that listens to us in chunks and then doesn't listen to us for like 4 months in a row and then comes back and just guns through every episode, you're already out of luck because it's probably October and you're too late.
But if you're keeping up with things.
August 31st, I hear people talk to me about that all the time.
Yes,
they're like, I haven't listened to you guys in like 5 months, but I've banked all the episodes and I'm going to gun through them on this road trip, you know.
Also, if you are one of the listeners who lives in a place where art house movies just don't come, where you've got not enough screens in town and not an audience, and, you know, you talk about how, I love the movies y'all are talking about, but I don't know when I'm going to get to see them, or I bank them, I put them on a list somewhere for the day that they're going to be streaming. Guess what? They're streaming on Ovid.tv.
This is the thing, because I know, like, everyone loves Criterion Channel.
Sure.
You get Canopy free somewhere if you got a library card, and those are wonderful. But the thing about Ovid is that it's art house, and it is, like, art house.
Well, some of your favorite distributors.
That's my jam. Some of my favorite film distributors put their stuff through Ovid.
Yeah.
So, like, movies that aren't available on any other streaming platform
absolutely
are on Ovid. And you can put it on your Apple TV.
Your Roku.
Roku.
All the places.
Oh, yeah, whatever. I don't know what else.
Your Bird Box. I don't know. Whatever you got.
I watched it on my Bird Box.
So yeah,
maybe
Ovid.tv, y'all. Okay, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
All right, so we have to talk about it in a way that doesn't spoil it,
which we can do,
and then we can do a little break, and then we can.
We will give you fair warning when the spoilers start coming.
Why don't you talk about this new film, the ninth film.
The ninth, unquote, film.
The ninth film from Quentin Tarantino, his penultimate, apparently.
So he says.
He says there's only going to be one more, that Star Trek movie that he's working on.
Yeah.
Well, and then that's the end.
I somehow believe none of this, but, it is his ninth.
Then, much like Steven Soderbergh,
he's going
never
to
going to make anything else
and Ingmar
again.
Bergman and everybody, and Hayao Miyazaki. It's his ninth film if you count Kill Bill as one and if you don't count Four Rooms. So,
well, that was a short film.
I know, but it's still, you know, he doesn't say the ninth feature.
I can see, you and I are about to parse a lot of words here.
Look, why, you know, why be so anal about counting your own movies? Come on.
He wanted to rank them before anyone else did.
No, he just wanted The Hateful Eight to be number eight, and he's just been coasting on that ever since.
Right, no, I know. Oh, by the way, I'm over all the rankings. I don't know when did everyone decide that every new film from every new director needed to be personally ranked by you or any film critic or any... Listen, no one rank anything from now on forever. Like, I know that I just wrote...
I was going to say.
I know I just wrote a piece for The Wrap about the ranking Jim Jarmusch films, but you guys, do you know why I did that? Money.
Well, that's the thing.
I did that for money.
If people,
it wasn't even a lot of money, but it was money.
If people didn't,
and I love money. If people, what do I not like? Ranking things.
If people didn't click on these ranking pieces, then they wouldn't exist. So
click on the ones I write for money, and ignore everyone else.
As the grandmother says on Years and Years, we're all to blame. It's all our fault.
Listen, a film critic's job is to have a list at the end of the year. Every time a director puts out a new movie is not an occasion for everyone in the whole dang world to have a ranking list.
Get ready.
What?
For when Hobbs and Shaw opens.
Right.
Because everyone on Twitter is going to rank the Fast and Furious movies. They just are, and there's a...
Well, they're all getting blocked.
Well, good luck with that.
I'm blocking all of you.
You'll have... The film Twitter will disappear.
Maybe I'll just mute.
You could do that.
I'll soft block you.
There you go. Or you could just put, like... You could put Hobbs and Shaw in the you know, you can tell Twitter to like shield you from certain phrases and things.
You can.
Oh yeah.
Really?
Yes.
Oh.
Like if you're behind on some TV show and you don't want to hear spoilers, you can put in like the title and be like, you will not see tweets with that in it. It's very exciting.
Oh, I'll tell you what. Now I have a list.
A list of things
I don't want to ever be bothered by again on Twitter.
So, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. All right. It stars Leonardo DiCaprio and Brad Pitt as DiCaprio plays an aging TV Western star named Rick Dalton. And Brad Pitt is his stunt double, but Man Friday. The movie describes him as more than a brother, less than a wife. Cliff something. I forget. And
I referred to him as Brad Pitt.
Yes, Brad Pitt. And they are making their way through late 60s Hollywood, which is a period of tumult.
1969 specifically.
Well,
starts in February, ends in August.
Okay, I thought it jumped ahead a year at some point. Like it was 68, then 69.
You see, at the very, very beginning, you see footage from the show that DiCaprio's character
called
Bounty Law, which took place in the late 1950s.
Am I telling this story?
You're going to as soon as I finish helping you.
Brother. Anyway, so Rick Dalton is at a weird place in his career. He's doing a lot of one-offs on other TV shows, playing villains, which a producer played by Al Pacino tells him is a bad idea because ultimately it's going to make audiences stop thinking of him in character and just think, oh wow, that's Rick Dalton getting beaten up every week. Because Pacino wants him to go to Italy to make spaghetti westerns, which is what a lot of American He-Men of this era were doing.
Right.
In a seemingly unrelated story, we follow Sharon Tate through her life. She lives in a house on Cielo Drive with her husband Roman Polanski and happens to be next door neighbors to Rick Dalton. She goes to a party at the Playboy Mansion with Jay Sebring. She goes to the Bruin to see herself in the Dean Martin, Matt Helm comedy, The Wrecking Crew. She buys her husband a first edition of Tess of the D'Urbervilles. She listens to Paul Revere and the Raiders. She puts her bare feet on a movie theater seat, and I'm sorry, I don't care how much of a foot fetish you have, Quentin Tarantino, that is inexcusable.
Is that... Okay. Let's talk about feet for just a moment.
We have to. We are forced.
First of all, let's talk about real life. In real life, do not put your feet on anything that another person's head or face is going to be near, or hands or body or anything. And I don't care if you're wearing shoes or not wearing shoes, don't do it. I will never forget nor forgive Pauly Shore for the day that we sat next to him at the old Jinkies on Sunset. It was a breakfast place. And he put his feet on the table while he talked to his friends. He was wearing shoes, and he put his feet on the table. And no one who worked at Jinkies made him stop doing this. And when they left, they merely when they left the table clearing person just wiped it like it was any normal moment of wiping the table. I thought, you need to really clean. If someone has put their foot on your table at your restaurant,
the bleach.
Clean the table thoroughly. I've never met Pauly Shore in person, but the day I do,
he's gonna get an earful.
Oh, I've been carrying this around for 9 years.
Say, this was quite a while ago.
9 years.
Jinkies isn't even open anymore.
Listen, I'm an elephant. Never forget. anyway, Quentin Tarantino's foot enthusiasm is on full display here in this movie. And
it's the one thing he has in common with Buñuel.
Like, okay, because it's 1969 and the world is overrun with hippies. They all walked around with no shoes on.
Sharon Tate is wearing white go-go boots before this.
No. She's wearing sort of like strappy mid-heel kind of things. Okay. And she kicks them off.
She has shoes that she removes.
She takes the foot off and puts the feet on the chair. But you can tell she's been walking around on the ground because about the bottoms, she has dirty, dirty feet.
Mm-hmm.
And so does Margaret Qualley.
Yes.
And so does, who else?
Margaret Qualley, who splays hers on Brad Pitt's dashboard.
Here's the thing. I think QT's a little bisexual for feet because he loves Leo's feet too in this film.
Do we see Leo's
feet? Uh-huh. In the pool. All kicked up and
right in your face.
Camera, and I was like, so you just like everybody's feet?
There's also, I have to say, you know, there's a moment where Brad Pitt climbs to the roof of DiCaprio's house to fix the TV antenna or whatever, and it is a homoerotic moment of like shirt removal.
Oh, it is, yeah. Well, because Brad Pitt knows how to do that.
Yeah, yeah. And QT knows how to shoot it.
The
anyway,
so I don't have an aesthetic or moral problem with his goofy obsession, because I feel like at this point in his career, he's saying to Margaret Qualley and to Margot Robbie, okay, put your dirty feet up on this dashboard or on this chair, and here's the camera right in it. They know, and they said to him, oh, I get to be part of cinema history now. I'm one of your foot ladies.
I'll eventually be in your Oscar clip reel. Here's the thing.
It's goofy and weird, and I'm not creeped out by I'm
not
silly.
Creeped out by it. It takes me out of the film a little, though.
Well, it does take me out of the film because it's him waving his hands in your face, like, being like, hey, check it out. Check out what I really like.
here's an example. Alfred Hitchcock.
Yes.
Once he realized that people were looking for his cameo,
yes,
started knocking them out really early.
Early in the film.
So as not to distract people. By the time you get to the Birds, it's in the opening credits.
Yes.
Like it's just like, boom, we're done. Okay, you saw it. Now our story.
Yeah.
Every time a woman puts her feet, or a man puts her feet, get front and center, I'm like, okay, thank you for reminding
me the movie
that I'm watching a film de Quentin Tarantino. Lil Can-Can. Where was I? Okay, so...
Gratuitous feet.
So L.A. is crawling with hippies.
Yes.
And some of those hippies live at Spawn Ranch.
Yes,
and
they do.
Brad Pitt meets one of them.
One of those hippies is Lena Dunham.
Yes.
I was like, wait a second. No one told me she was in this movie.
There's a whole, it's a fat, that's a whole interesting crew. Like Maya Hawke is one of them, the daughter of Uma Thurman and Ethan Hawke, who was just in Stranger Things. Harley Quinn Smith is one of them.
Is Lily Rose Depp in this? Or no, she's in the
Harley
new.
Quinn Smith.
Harley Quinn Smith.
Lily Rose Depp is in the new Louis Garrel movie.
Louis Garrel, right.
So, Brad Pitt gives Margaret Call a lift to Spawn Ranch, wonders what exactly is going on there. It's a fairly tense scene with an interesting resolution. All of which is to give the movie a sense of foreboding about what we know happens between the people living in Spawn Ranch and Sharon Tate. Yes. In the meantime, however, the film is a luxurious wallow in late 60s Los Angeles and show business.
Yeah.
The, you know, what TV sets are like and what Italian, you know, exploitation films are like and what Hollywood Boulevard and Sunset Boulevard and all those things looked like and who was on the radio, both the DJs and the music.
Right.
And what was it like to go to a swinging party at Hef's house? And
what was it like to walk down a street in Los Angeles with all those movie theaters and all those marquees?
Yes.
Because that's another obsession.
Right.
Obviously, of Quentin Tarantino.
You know, what's it like to be a middle-aged white
man? And I share that obsession with him.
Oh, totally.
Nothing I love more than seeing those old marquees.
Believe me, this movie pushes a lot of my buttons in that, yes, I he and I have many overlapping interests and obsessions.
Right.
You know, we find out what it's like to be a middle-aged stuntman, white stuntman, who can somehow magically beat the crap out of Bruce Lee.
Right.
And so the movie, you know, it has a very ramshackle pace the way that Tarantino does.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it works, and sometimes your butt might twitch a little, like, where are we going here? Depending on how into it you are and your tolerance for the way he tells a story. Building to a climax that we will not reveal yet.
Right now.
That we'll talk about
in a few
later
moments.
In the show. So if you haven't seen the movie yet, we're not spoiling it for you.
We will tell you when the spoilers are coming. So don't freak out. We're not going to just spring them on you.
It is now tricky for me to talk about my issues with the movie without getting into the spoiler parts.
Oh, try.
But I will be vague.
Okay.
I think that this is a movie about... This is a middle-aged white filmmaker who is possibly fearing obsolescence.
Uh-huh.
As somebody pointed out, you know, in the 90s, his whole, you know, when he first started out, it was like, yeah, he was a video store clerk, and now he's a filmmaker.
Right.
And today's young audiences are like, what's a video store? So, you know, his you know, he may be at past his peak, possibly, or, you know, that's a consideration. Making a movie about other white guys who are past their peak.
Mm-hmm.
And then the movie, rather than sort of address that, ultimately becomes about how aren't middle-aged white guys amazing and don't they make everything happen? And so I found that a little annoying. And he does so with an ending that is going to be divisive.
Yes.
And I find myself tilting towards the end of it, rather than the whoa end of it. That said, I think people should see it for what we were saying before, for just the immersiveness of the milieu, the time and place. You know, Robert Richardson shot it. The costumes are great.
Yep.
The casting is on point. There are a lot of great performances, a lot of great moments. Like, there's a scene where DiCaprio, who is playing yet another Rick Dalton, who's playing another bad guy in another Western show, has a scene with a young actress played by Julia Butters of American Housewife.
She would prefer that you not use the word actress.
Sorry. Yes, the character insists on being called an actor.
Yes.
It's a great moment that I think encapsulates a lot of, you know, what I was saying before about the whole kind of middle-age obsolescence issue. You know, there's a lot I like about this movie, but there's also a lot that just has me kind of annoyed with it in the way that I often get annoyed with Quentin Tarantino and his methods and his messages. And
yes.
And it's funny because I think there's a part of me that thinks because we are close in age, also, you know, also movie obsessed, you know, that
right.
kind of thing.
Right.
I feel like I'm in a position where I either have to be I should either be completely on board with him and feel like every time he makes a movie, like, oh, I feel seen.
Yes.
Or, like, I know what you're doing well enough to call you out on this. Mm-hmm. And I usually am at the latter, where I'm like, I know where you're coming from. I know exactly what you're doing here, and I don't like it.
I will be very vague right now.
Yes.
I mostly love this movie.
Okay.
The things I don't love about it are quite troubling.
Hmm.
And we will talk about that
after.
At the end, when we talk about the spoilers.
Yes.
Because I see him as a filmmaker who wants to have his cake and eat it too.
Totally.
And I don't know the answer to how he can
do that.
And still be, and I hate this word, but it's the only word that comes to mind right now, be sort of responsible.
You know? No, that's valid, yeah.
In general, I on principle, I would say, no, I don't want responsible filmmaking. I want freedom.
Sure.
And he has that freedom, and he exercises it every time he wants to.
Mm-hmm.
But there's so much about this I love, but there's always going to be a part about it that nags at me. And I want to really get into that with you when we start talking about it.
Well, it's funny that
but
you...
But I... Go on.
I was going to say, it's funny you use the word responsible, because I was reminded how... Was it The Living End that was billed as an irresponsible
movie
by Greg Araki?
The one that made people yell and scream at the show I went to in Dallas in 1991 or 2 at the Inwood Theater. All the gay Republicans who went to that opening night, they were not happy.
But it's one
and
thing.
They were booing and yelling at the end.
It's one thing when a queer Asian filmmaker makes an irresponsible film in 1991.
Yes.
It's another thing when a white straight filmmaker makes an irresponsible film in 2019.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
I love all the things about it that you love. I love the look of it. I love the pace. Anyone who complains about it being too slow or boring, go watch something else. Seriously, because you are meant to sort of luxuriate in the things that he wants to show you. And if you don't love those things, then sure, you're going to be bored. But why are you here? Have you never seen a film from this man before? Because the past few, particularly the past few that he's made, have been longer. And they take their time.
Hateful Eight had an intermission.
They take their time. Oh, I was angry that this one did not, because here's a wonderful thing about living in Los Angeles. When a film like this opens in Los Angeles, certain theaters in the city will just go round the clock. They will screen this film round the clock. You can go see it at 2 a.m., 4 a.m., 6 a.m., 8 a.m., doesn't matter.
Star Wars, Avengers, and Quentin Tarantino.
Did you work a night shift and you got off at 6? You want to go to the 7 a.m.? Hit it. There it is. It's right there for you. So I was there on Sunday morning at 8 a.m. at the Arclight in a very, very, very underpopulated theater.
Wow.
My favorite.
Yes.
I even checked out who was at the 7 a.m. because... the 7 a.m. was in the dome in 70 millimeter in the Cinerama Dome. And I looked at the seating chart online to see if I wanted to buy a ticket where I could be. It was packed.
Wow.
7 a.m. Sunday morning, packed the dome.
Well, those 70 millimeter people are...
Yeah. But this, the one
and
I saw
was
at
35.
8 o'clock in the morning, and it was in 35 in one of the big Arclight houses, big comfy seats. The seats at the Cinerama Dome are not comfortable. Ever.
They're the seats from the 60s, basically.
Yeah.
Maybe not literally, but size-wise.
Listen, I'm fat. I need a big, nice, comfy chair.
Yes.
So, I got a big, green tea from the concession stand, because we have lovely concession stands in Los Angeles where you can get yourself a nice green tea if you're going to an 8 a.m. screening.
And a scone.
And a, well, get a chocolate chip muffin.
Right.
Yeah. Don't call it a scone. You don't live over there.
I was giving you air quotes with my face.
In this country, we call it a scone. It is,
of course, it's a scone.
Yeah.
Scones mean no, muffins mean yes.
Yes. So the, I remember seeing Hateful Eight at around the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember them saying, there will be an intermission.
Right.
And I thought, oh, yes. Well, there's no intermission here.
Nope.
And they didn't announce it, and I thought, there's not going to be one. So the minute I started thinking, okay, I got to go, and this movie's only been on for like 70 minutes, there are 70 more minutes in this film. I jumped up and missed 2 entire minutes of it.
I have to say, even though there were moments where I thought the pacing was a little, even by Tarantino standards, like, come on already, I never felt comfortable thinking, like, I can go to the bathroom now. Like, I was worried about missing something, I just gritted my teeth and wrote it out.
I thought, listen, whatever I miss, I'll probably see this again. So I'll see, whatever those 2 minutes were,
you'll make
I'm
up
sure
for
they
it.
Were great.
And look, that's, if I'm
When
not,
I was a child, when you were a child, uh-huh. any movie you went to see had an intermission, is that correct?
No.
No?
No.
Well, let me tell you something.
Unless it was like, you know, Reds or Chitty Chitty Bang Bang or something really long, no.
When I was a little kid, it did not matter what movie I was there for. In Portsmouth, New Hampshire in the 1970s, when I was a child in elementary school and being dropped off at the local theater by my mother on a Saturday afternoon, alone.
Your favorite.
My favorite thing. 8 years old, already an adult. I can go to the movies by myself. Always an intermission. It didn't matter what film it was.
So
they put intermissions.
Would it just stop?
It would just stop.
Did they have a slide that said intermission?
Yeah, or? They would stop. The film would just stop at the end of a reel or whatever. Uh-huh. And then the screen would go and say, intermission. And then it'd be like 10 minutes.
No,
15
never
minutes.
Had that. And unless
then,
it was like some
didn't matter
really
what the movie
long
was,
movie.
Intermission. It could be a 90-minute movie. Intermission.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, it was perfect. So it's such a good. I wish that was the case. All the time.
I hear in some countries it is, actually. And like, yeah. No matter how abrupt it just stops.
Yeah.
But they'll just do that so that Fine. They can sell more concessions or whatever.
Yes. Don't you want to get up and have a stretch? Go to the bathroom? Get yourself some more mozzarella sticks? Yes, you do.
I do like an intermission when they offer one.
You go to the opera for the Fathom events. Sometimes you'll get 2 intermissions because that opera's like 4 hours long. It's the best.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It is a testament to how much that I did enjoy this movie that I did not go to the movie.
I also found this film much more thoughtful and understanding of what it means for actors to live and to see themselves acting, and for what it means for us to watch them act.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll get more into that as we talk spoilers.
Yeah.
It's very moving. The final 20 minutes, final 15-ish minutes, are where I became the most troubled and also where I became the most moved. And And it doesn't wait until that last 15 minutes. It builds this sort of sense of sadness because you know what happens in real life. And so each moment in this film that moves itself forward is bringing you to a place where, I mean, he wants you to go.
Yeah.
But it's very emotional.
The final sequence also called to mind for me a lot of my issues with Tarantino and his female characters, but we'll get into
right.
that.
Right, that's what I was referring
yeah, okay.
to. Yeah.
Well, yeah, we'll get into that in the spoilers.
So yeah, no, I'm very much on this film's side,
mm-hmm.
In spite of the things that I find troubling about it.
You know, I kind of fall in the category of, like, as much as many issues as I have with Tarantino, he is not to be ignored.
Right.
And this movie does offer its share of pleasures that will stay with you even if you have massive problems with the things that you'll have problems with.
So let's read letters.
Okay.
And then we'll go back and talk even more about this.
Yes.
In depth. And we'll be able to talk about what happens in the film.
Yes.
To make our point.
Before we get to letters, just a quick reminder, we do have a Patreon page.
We sure do.
We offer extra content like LKTV, a podcast. That is correct. Television, Linoleum Knife and Fork. A
food. Maybe you heard LKTV for the first time yesterday.
Yeah.
That was an unusual episode of LKTV.
Yeah, we don't often have guests.
We don't usually have guests, and usually the format of LKTV is...
current television.
What did we just watch on TV this week?
Yeah.
And what do we think about it? And because we had guests whose... their own podcast is about television, we thought it was a good fit. And also, they devote an entire podcast to television that you use as comfort food and that I wish didn't exist. So I loved having them as guests because they represent a thing that I hate so much.
The thing they talk about, not them.
The thing that those guys. Listen, those guys are great. Yeah. Like I knew they were cool.
Yeah,
but I got great confirmation of it in person. Yesterday.
Yeah.
And so.
We also do Linoleum Knife and Fork, which is a food podcast hosted by two film critics.
Yes.
And Linoleum Nights, the one that we do on Facebook Live, and Work Blue, and talk about current events. But so many other cool things as well. You can have a custom-made private knife, a 20-minute podcast about any topic that you throw at us.
What do you like? What do you want us to talk about? We'll talk about it.
For you and you alone.
Yep.
Also, monthly club meetings where we get together and watch a movie on Netflix and hang out in a Google Hangout room and talk about it.
I'm so excited. I'm going to tell you this now. I'm telling you this right now. I have chosen our August club meeting movie. Our
hot August club meeting.
We had a bit of a disagreement in July. You really wanted to watch Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse.
I did.
And I like Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. I think it's a great film. But I just sort of like, I just saw it, right? And
it benefits from repeat viewing.
And it really does, because things I realized things I didn't see before.
Yeah.
But I was real gung-ho for another movie that you were like, eh, but now we're going to do it in August.
Yes, yeah, so you can take the lead on this convo when we do it.
Roadhouse.
Yes, not the Ida Lupino one.
Not the Ida Lupino Roadhouse. Swayze, which, by the way, if you've never seen the Ida Lupino Roadhouse from 1946, 1947, wonderful film. She is at her tough-talking peak in Roadhouse. But I'm talking, the one we're going to watch for club meeting.
Rowdy Harrington.
Patrick Swayze. Slaughtering everyone in Roadhouse.
It's Patrick Swayze Christmas in August.
Yeah. I'm thrilled. I cannot wait. I'm gonna like eat an entire pint of ice cream while I watch it with you guys.
Anyway, and of course, t-shirts and mugs and pins and Christmas ornaments and other things with our logo on it. So yes. patreon.com/linoleum.
Oh,
check it out.
Be ready. It's August, and I have nothing to do in August except fulfill all of your Patreon needs. So if you're waiting for something to show up in the mail, and you've already told me what it is, it's coming in August. This is my month of doing nothing except Patreon. Like, you can cook your own meals.
Fine.
You can clean the bathroom. You can vacuum and dust. You're going to do everything. Yeah, you're fending for yourself. If you haven't told me yet what thing it is you want, please tell me at dlelandwhite1964@gmail.com. That is D. Leland White. That's my middle name, Leland. 1964. That's the year I was born. @gmail. And this week I'm going to be posting photos of all those things that are prizes, in case you forgot what they were. So...
You know what? I was thinking, instead of you doing a million Patreon posts,
yes,
I'm going to show you how to make a collage so you can do one post with all
great.
The pictures in it.
Sure.
It'll be very exciting.
Fine.
Excellent. All right. What do we got letters, sir?
Dr. Steve.
Mm-hmm.
Who says, Billy Porter should be the next 007 supervillain.
Ooh.
Now that we have a black female 007, She needs the perfect foil. And since the best villains are always the treacherous gay. Thank you, Dr. Steve. I was hoping that would catch on. I've been using the expression treacherous gay for some time now. And I'm, you know, I don't want too much public attention because it bothers me. But I do want my wisdom and my ideas to become part of the common vernacular.
Wasn't Javier Bardem a treacherous gay?
He was. And he was delightful.
Why not?
So he says, and since the best villains are always the treacherous gay, who better than Billy Porter to chew the super spy scenery? Also, he's long overdue to start cashing those movie star paychecks.
Oh, totally agreed. Now, here's the thing.
You know what, though? TV money is better than movie money.
That's true. It is ongoing, and you get the residuals.
Ongoing, yeah.
Movies, you get TV money is better.
Why do you think they all want to get a show? Everybody wants a show.
I am still proceeding with care on the whole black female 007 thing.
Why?
Because they've made it clear that James Bond is retired. She has inherited his number.
Yeah.
And he's going to come back out of retirement for whatever blah, blah adventure is going on.
Maybe to help out from here from time to time. Maybe he's going to carry her luggage.
I just don't think that the franchise is miraculously going to become like Foxy Brown overnight. I think it's going to be... It's still going to be some white guy being
Oh, you
James
don't think
Bond.
It's real? You don't think this is real?
No. I think it's real, but like I see a scenario where... He gets pulled out of retirement. They go on some adventure together. She dies nobly. He becomes 007 again.
Oh!
I'm just saying.
Really?
I don't see this as a long-term investment of let's make the 007 series be about a black woman. Okay. As awesome as that would be,
All right.
I don't see that happening.
It never occurred to me that they would just kill her.
Yeah, if you think they're surrendering hegemony on this one, forget it.
Listen, I'm so easy to... fool. I'm just like, oh good, like this is gonna happen, and then
forever.
Yeah.
We'll see how it goes.
James says, my only expectation with the Cats trailer was that Ian McKellen looked more convincing in a cat suit than the one he wore in an episode of the TV series Vicious, where he proposes to his partner, played by Derek Jacobi, in his character's costume when he performed Cats.
Yes.
This was not met, and yet I will more than likely still be there opening night like a moth to an open flame. Oh, yeah, you and me both, James. Oh,
can't wait. If you look on YouTube...
This freak show is where I'm at.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I'm so ready already.
This is my happening. If you look on YouTube, you can see the clip from Vicious of McKellen in the cat suit. It's pretty hilarious.
Wilson... says, dear Alonzo, you recently posted with appreciation a notice about the 35th anniversary of the film Electric Dreams. I had never heard of this film. I looked at the IMDb entry, and it sounds like this is a remake of Cyrano de Bergerac, where the part of Cyrano is played by a 1984 desktop PC. Please explain yourself when you have recovered from Outfest, of course.
That is exactly what the plot of Electric Dreams is. And it is a silly movie, but it's a charming movie. And right. I think it has a lot of... It is a very 1984 film in that it was... a concerted effort to bring the MTV aesthetic to the big screen. In fact, like, you know, it was, I remember the ads even said, from the director of the Billie Jean video.
Yeah.
Like, that was supposed to get people into theaters. You know, it has two very attractive and appealing leads, played by Virginia Madsen and Lenny Von Dolan. Bud Cort is the voice of the PC. And, you know, the film sort of caresses the textures of, like, coffee tables and cellos as much as they do the faces of the leading of the romantic leads. It's also got Maxwell Caulfield in it. It has a great soundtrack, and sadly I think it's because of the soundtrack that it's never really been released on DVD in this country, because apparently there are music clearance issues. So it's the kind of movie you have to really chase down, either in, you know, rare screenings. I did see it at the New Beverly a few years ago, or like, you know, if you have like an international DVD player or whatever. But if you can see Electric Dreams, again, it is a silly movie. Do not like invest in it as anything important. It is a cool snapshot of its moment. It's got a lot of great music. pick up the soundtrack if you find it anywhere. And yeah, it's goofy, but I have a very soft spot in my heart for it. Have you seen it?
No.
Oh wow.
You've managed to trap me in your net for these past going on 24 years.
Yes.
And somehow I have wiggled my way out of seeing Electric Dreams.
Ooh, I sense a make me coming around.
Or do
the
you? Is that what you sense?
Maybe. Mm. Maybe.
Watch what you make me do. Because when it's my turn to make you.
I don't know if I want to.
This might be revenge cinema.
I don't know if I want to expend a make me on this. You won't suffer in this movie. You'll just find it kind of glossy and.
I'll be like, why am I watching this?
Pointless, but yeah. Whatever. That's not necessarily a bad thing.
And now we are going to spoil.
Yes, we are.
Once Upon a Time, Ellipsis.
In Hollywood.
And we're going to do that in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, now.
Y'all, Sharon Tate doesn't die. And it's funny, when the film premiered at Cannes.
Say it again slowly, because you said it so quickly that. If it were me, uh-huh. I would have to rewind to be like, what did he just blah, 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 out of his mouth?
Sharon Tate
does not
die.
Correct.
In this telling, when the film premiered at Cannes, where I was not, I kept hearing how they were being very adamant with critics, please, 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 do not give away, you know, the twists of the story and the ending and da da da. And my first thought was, oh. They stopped the Manson killers. Because the last time there was...
It never occurred to me.
The last time there was a big twist
yes.
in a Tarantino movie.
Right.
Jewish soldiers kill Hitler in a burning theater.
Well, that's not the last twist. Because in Django Unchained, they destroy a plantation.
Right. But that doesn't have the same... oomph is killing Hitler.
I know, but still, it's this film and Django Unchained
uh-huh.
and Inglourious Basterds are, in my head, now that I've seen all three,
uh-huh.
they are a trilogy of sorts in which...
Of revisionist history.
In which history is rewritten
yes.
in the final moments.
Yes.
And to one degree or another.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So, the... obviously, the killing of Hitler is monumental. They don't stop slavery in Django, but they stop a chunk of it. And here, he rescues Sharon Tate from her fate.
Yes. And by extension, if we're to believe Joan Didion, the 1960s.
If we are to extend it to the entirety of the era.
Yeah.
Because Joan Didion famously wrote that the Manson killings were the end of the 1960s.
Yeah.
And
someone suggested
it makes sense that that is you know, that and Altamont.
I would say somebody said the sequel should be Rick and Cliff go to Altamont.
Yeah.
You
know? So these three films taken together are kind of a trilogy of Quentin Tarantino teaches you drunk history. Like
it's sort of like Quentin Tarantino can do it, so he will do it.
So he will do it, correct.
So obviously this raises a lot of different issues here.
Right.
It takes, you know, the film's portrayal of Sharon Tate is not particularly deep, but given the timeline and what we know about what's going to be happening, it imbues those scenes with a sense of tragedy anyway, which now, of course, is completely subverted. Like yesterday, it's not really interested in the far-reaching implications. Like, you could make a whole other movie now of what pop culture and other things would be like had this gone down, had the Mansons been stopped, had, you know, had Sharon Tate not been murdered, you know, what does that mean for Roman Polanski's career?
I love that we call them the Mansons as though like that's their, they're really a family and that's their last name.
The Manson
like
cultists all the... had been stopped, you know,
Shirley Manson
with Marilyn, would this failure have led to like Manson being arrested still, or would they have just kind of drifted off? As failures, who knows? Like, anyway, we'll never know. None of that stuff is covered. Like, this is all the very end of the movie. But it also gets into this thing where Cliff and then Rick take out Tex and I forget which of the two Manson women,
Sadie, I think.
Uh huh.
And I can't remember now who else.
So you know, they are dispatched in a way that is. You know, yes, they are bad people with bad intentions, and the movie revels in their destruction.
Right.
But even taking that as a starting point for how that last sequence goes, there is a relishing of violence against women in these movies.
Oh, yeah. The camera in this movie.
Yeah, in this movie, but this is a thing that's come up in the past with Tarantino in Hateful Eight, certainly, and in Jackie Brown and some other films, where Tarantino in general is a splatter hound and a grindhouse, you know, aficionado, and all the violence is in your face and you know, excessive.
Yes.
But he seems to revel in violence against women in a way that I found really off-putting. Like, yes... These are people who are, you know, like on acid and in a cult and came to do a terrible thing to innocent people. That doesn't mean that I want to see these women get their faces smashed into telephones and stone fireplace mantle pieces and set on fire.
Right.
And so maybe that makes me, you know, a beta cuck social justice warrior.
You're the cuck boss.
Thank you.
I was, you know, obviously hoping that my, you know, that I would be known as cuck boss, but...
I won fair and square.
You won. Yeah, you did. You won.
If you had campaigned in Michigan and Ohio, it might have gone completely differently.
I ran a good race.
Yes. So that just... You know, I'm still trying to wrap my head around the larger implications of what if Sharon Tate lived and whether or not that's an ending that you should do or could do or whatever. Like, I see both sides of that, and part of it is his historical revisionism, and it's part of his, you know, like, wouldn't it be nice? At the same time, though, the stuff with the Manson women put me off. And then also, again... For a movie that is about impending obsolescence, to do an ending in which, like, these fading white guys save the 60s, you know, it is, like, double plus wish fulfillment. Because it's not just about rescuing Sharon Tate. It's about rescuing Sharon Tate at the hands of these old actors and stuntmen whom, you know, Tarantino has always revered. You know, you see him finding roles for people like Robert Forster and Michael Parks and stuff, which is fine, and that's great, and those are interesting actors, and I'm glad that he gave them the opportunities to shine. But to make them so heroic in a movie that is about a changing Hollywood speaks to a real conservatism that is kind of creepy.
It has a reactionary quality. Totally. Absolutely. I think that Tarantino's obsession with genre film of the, you know, particularly of the 60s and 70s.
Yes.
Puts him in a bind sometimes because he's not just devoted to these films and these actors, these old character actors, and he clearly is.
Yeah.
But he's devoted to the mechanics of them and the aesthetics of them. He is devoted to their understanding of reality and the understanding of genre films. A genre film's understanding of reality is kind of a parallel track.
Sure.
To the way real human beings, you know, think about reality.
Yeah.
It's rough. They're almost always, they are rougher, more brutal. They're less concerned with the nuances of good and bad. They're more likely concerned with issues of very simplistic, you know, justice and revenge. And so I think what happens is when you become as submerged in that world as he is, mm-hmm. when you become sort of the leading cultural, you know,
champion,
proponent and champion of this type of filmmaking, mm-hmm. what happens is, you know, you're devoted to the, sort of the gnarliest aspects of these films. And within that, as the world moves on and our understanding of, you know, what would be the best way for people to live with each other? What would be the best way for films to acknowledge the humanity of other people who are not, you know, middle-aged white character actors?
Right.
You enter a series of problems that I think Tarantino acknowledges mm-hmm. and that he has a love-hate relationship with
right.
at this point, but that he knows he cannot solve.
And I think part of that might have to do with the fact that, as you say, these the three films that you're putting together, the revisionist yeah. Trilogy, these are films that are based in history.
Yes.
Like, you know, and actual historical events,
yes.
whereas like Pulp Fiction, Kill Bill, Jackie Brown to an extent, certainly Reservoir Dogs, and even Hateful Eight are like genre exercises.
Yeah, they're films that exist because of other films.
Yeah, exactly. and so to take that, like, I'm going to this genre lens and put it onto World War II or, you know, the Manson murders, whatever, then it's like, wait, but that's not what the world is, but that's how you see things.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Right. So what I often, what I see him doing is he sort of toggles back and forth mm-hmm. between, particularly visually, because there seems to be almost a post-genre critique of them
uh-huh.
in some ways, but also in more often, just a total indulgence.
Yes.
In them. And I think sometimes there's nothing he loves more than to give you something that is clearly a reference to something else.
Sure.
That might or might not have a bearing on what comes later. So, for example, the Brad Pitt character cannot get stunt work with anyone except Leo.
Yes.
Because no other stunt person in the industry wants to work with him. And the reason no other stunt person in the industry wants to work with him, particularly like the two biggest ones who are played by Kurt Russell and Zoe Bell as a husband and wife stunt coordinating team.
Right.
Zoe Bell, as you know, is the extreme badass who held onto a car all through Death Proof
yes.
on the hood.
The ship's
and
mask.
Kept going.
Mm-hmm.
And
they won't work with him because
he's Robert Wagner.
He.
This is clearly a reference to Robert Wagner. Robert Wagner has been for decades under this weird cloud, you know. His wife, Natalie Wood, died in a boat accident. And she was on a boat with Robert Wagner and Christopher Walken.
Mm-hmm.
And she fell overboard and drowned. As of 2018, Robert Wagner is once again a person of interest in this investigation that has suddenly just started opened up again.
Right.
And for decades, he's worked his way through Hollywood, and people have said, oh, well, that's so sad. Your wife died. And I'm sure, you know, there's something out there that we just still don't know.
Yeah.
But this, the rumor for decades, the legend of this is right. now, what if he did it? And it's everywhere you go. When this subject comes up, and you talk about Robert Wagner, the issue is,
did he?
Yeah. We may never know.
Yeah.
And the film shows you that Brad Pitt's wife, and you only see her for 10 seconds, and she's terrible.
Yes.
She's yelling at him for we don't know what reason. She's just angry.
She's another naggy Tarantino female character.
She dies. And we don't see how, and we don't know why, and we don't know if he did it, But the rumor that dogs him, his yes. character, is he murdered his wife and got away with it on a boat. So that storyline doesn't go very many places other than it is an understanding. There's an understanding that he's capable of that kind of brutality. Right. And we know it because of the ending.
Yes.
Where he beats the... He destroys people.
And we've seen it before then, too.
Physically destroys people. He kicks Bruce Lee into a car in a mid film sequence. Bruce Lee, at that time in Hollywood, was on the Green Hornet, and yes. he was also a stunt coach.
Yes, like we see him yeah. later coaching Sharon Tate and Nancy Kwan for their yes. fight scene in The Wrecking Crew, which Margot Robbie is watching in the yeah. film.
So that's...
And we also see when he goes to Spawn Ranch, he beats the crap out of
right.
the other About dude, the other not guy. Tex, but the other
not
guy.
Not Tex. So I think what happens here is that you've got Tarantino rewriting the Sharon Tate story, but not lifting a finger to rewrite or to explore the rumor, the legend of yeah. Natalie Wood.
And also, we're meant to like the Brad Pitt character.
We are meant to like him.
Whether he killed his wife or not.
Yeah, yeah. That's strange and troubling.
Yeah. Look, it's garbage day again.
That doesn't bother me. Like, okay. the noise of the garbage truck is fine. Beeping. It's the beeping that makes me want to lose my head.
Right.
So I want to talk about the ending.
Okay.
I want to talk about the brutality of the ending.
Yeah.
His camera does seemingly take significantly more pleasure in the destruction of the two Manson women mm-hmm. than it does the destruction of the Manson guy.
Yes.
Manson guy is quickly and efficiently killed, and then the remaining action in the sequence is these two women being obliterated.
Yeah.
Here's me watching the movie. Because I share Tarantino's love of extreme, excessive... Wow, that was a big noise.
Yes.
Extreme, excessive, splattery violence.
Right.
In genre film, grindhouse film, you know...
the cinema.
The cinema in general. Claire Denis, Trouble Every
Day. I was
day.
Just going to say. Now on Ovid.tv.
My gut feeling initially when I see someone getting a telephone to the face is, yeah! And then I have a second thought. And my second thought is, well, it's the Manson people. Whatever it takes to save Sharon Tate, do it. That's my second thought. Mm-hmm. And then my third thought is, why does his camera love this so much? So even me, sitting in the movie, like, feeling like three conflicting things, knows that there is an element of misogyny in this camera work. Mm-hmm. There simply is.
Yes.
And I wonder sometimes if Tarantino sees that, or if he is so just invested in the aesthetics of splattery violence
right.
that nothing else is considered.
But again, I think that if the dispatching of the man were as exactly. lingered upon and as horrible...
Do we think that's even a conscious decision on his part?
So the question is, does he know and not care, or does he not even know?
I wonder if he even knows what he's doing in these kinds of moments. Like, no filmmaker is 100% aware of everything they
sure,
are.
Sure, yeah.
Sometimes things are slipping through, and it's just because of you being you.
That's what subtext...
And you haven't stopped to think about it in all of this time.
Right.
You know? I don't know the answer to that.
Hmm.
All I know is that scene left me feeling simultaneously like, yeah, get them, because they came to destroy.
Sure.
You know? They're the monsters.
Yeah.
You got to kill the monster. You got to kill the monster. You got to cut off the head.
Yes.
But we know from seeing the film, Charlie Says,
mm-hmm.
that these women, in real life, they were victims of a madman.
Yes.
They were victims of their own untreated, you know, vulnerability and perhaps mental illness.
Yes.
They were led by a man who was also mentally unwell.
They were exploited.
They were exploited, and they were controlled to the point of they would obey a killer to go and kill for him. In Charlie Says, we learn about the humanity of these women.
Yeah. Tarantino is not in the slightest bit interested.
Tarantino is not concerned about their humanity.
No.
He's concerned about them as symbols.
Yes.
And as the monster whose head must be cut off.
Right.
Or else it won't be killed.
But, you know, there's a way to film, to make a person into a monster before you do that to them.
Yeah.
Like, I always remember, remember in the Celluloid Closet where they compare the scenes of Sebastian Venable climbing the hill in Suddenly Last Summer to the end of Frankenstein?
Right.
How you don't see his face and how, like, the people are chasing after him and stuff.
Right.
Like, that's a way to sort of equate those two things so that his death is the death of a monster.
Right.
This has been a thing where we've seen them in the car having a sort of typically kind of funny and pop culture laden weird Tarantino conversation.
Yes.
One of them chickens out and takes the car away.
Yeah.
Like, they are human beings.
Right.
You know, and yes, they were there to do a terrible thing. And yes, they deserve to be taken out. But the way they are taken out, you're right. I think it's more than it needs to be. And who knows if he even thought about it that way.
My gut reaction is also informed by something that I wish I had never seen.
Yes.
I've been to the Museum of Death here in Los Angeles a few times. Out-of-towners, if they are of a mind to go to that kind of place, I'll take them. The one room I will not take them into is the Manson Room. Because my very first visit there, I went into the Manson Room unknowingly. And right on the wall are the crime scene photos. Mm-hmm. I have seen these crime scene photos. I know what Sharon Tate dead looks like. And I've never forgotten it. It shocked me and upset me and broke my heart when I saw it. And my protective feelings for her were there as I watched this film. So that when I realized what was about to happen, when I realized that he was about to give us his own version of history, and that she was going to live, and that they were going to die, I didn't care how they died.
I understand.
I was like, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. I know what really happened. I've seen the real photos of what they did to her. And in my gut, like I said, I had three conflicting ideas. One, yay, cool aesthetic splatter, because that's a thing I like. Two, yeah, get them. They were going to kill Sharon Tate. And my third thing, as I said, was, what does Tarantino think of violence against women?
Right.
Doesn't matter what woman it is.
And you're right. They committed a despicable act, and I think there is a way that the movie could have
addressed it.
But the movie has kind of, and I think this is one of its strengths in a way, is that it has shown the Manson cult to be kind of pathetic throughout. Like, Manson himself appears once or twice, and he just seems sort of sketchy and twitchy.
Yeah.
But like the He's barely in the film. But the his followers in the enclave, they all seem kind of like deluded and
aimless, sitting around watching TV, which is one of the things that this film is about.
People watching TV or watching movies.
Yeah.
So he demystifies them in a lot of ways, which is good because they weren't like this squad of ninja assassins. They were just these kids. Misguided hippies.
Yeah.
But then if you do that and then kill them that way, then you're not killing the monster. You're killing people who, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I would definitely recommend that everybody should go see Charlie Says. It is streaming. The Blu-ray is either out or coming out soon. And if you get the chance, go back a couple of episodes and listen to our interview with Guinevere Turner, who co-wrote the film with director Mary Harron.
Yeah.
She has a lot of insight about that. And, you know, you are most likely going to see this Tarantino movie. You should also see Charlie Says as a
absolutely, you must see Charlie Says.
Yes.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about Sharon Tate.
Okay.
And the implications of saving her.
Yes.
Because for me, there was again that moment of, right, yay, she lives. But by rescuing her, he creates a kind of negative space where you are forced to consider her real life death. Mm-hmm. You can't just walk out of the theater thinking, yay, he fixed it. He saved her. You are absolutely unable to not think about her real life death.
Yes.
And the sorrow of that. Because she wasn't merely a rising starlet. By all accounts, she was a lovely, wonderful person.
Yes.
And the film takes its time in setting up that idea. She is optimistic and she's full of hope. And she's, you know, a little sheepish about going to an afternoon matinee to watch herself in a movie, but she can't not do it.
Yeah.
And she's so thrilled to see herself on a poster. She's so excited to tell the box office woman, I'm in this movie. I'm from Valley of the Dolls.
And to hear the audience respond to her stuff.
Yeah. You know. And so you see her dancing and she's so free.
Mm-hmm.
And she loves people. Like, she loves her husband, Roman Polanski. She loves her ex-boyfriend, who's sort of like their best friend.
Yeah.
And she's so kind to everyone.
Did I tell you I met her sister?
Deborah Tate?
Yes.
I did not. When did you meet her?
At a
film festival.
At Jeffrey Schwartz's house.
Oh, okay.
And she's lovely, and yeah, everything that she said about Sharon is completely lines up with that.
And so, this film builds a melancholy that sort of envelops Margot Robbie, and Margot Robbie is so good with very little dialogue at communicating this person's hope for the future.
She's the anti-Tonya Harding.
Yeah. Her hope for the future that you already know doesn't come to pass. She was 26 when she was murdered. And so by rescuing her, again, I think he creates a negative space that forces you to consider the real life tragedy of her life. And it forces you to consider what would have happened to her. Would she have become a big movie star? Would she have become a TV star? Mm. Which is one of the themes of the film. Like, are you a real big deal? Or are you just kind of someone that people know?
Yeah.
You know, it forces you to consider the idea of Roman Polanski.
Yes.
Would he have stayed happily married to her with their child? Would he have, you know, 8 years later been in that hot tub?
Yeah.
We don't know.
By the way.
And that's something equally sorrowful to consider.
True. I would be remiss if we didn't point out in talking about this movie's issues with women and whatnot. The fact that he cast Emile Hirsch as Jay Sebring.
I don't think I didn't until like yesterday. I didn't know anything about Emile Hirsch's situation.
I had heard this like when it was happening. Yeah.
And if I had heard it, I forgot. Like, it was just like this little blip of news, maybe.
He pled guilty to physically assaulting a female Paramount executive at a party at Sundance.
At Sundance Film Festival.
Yeah. And I think, you know, obviously he has been less employable since then. So the fact that Tarantino's going out of his way to put him in his movie.
He plays Jay Sebring.
Yes. Yeah. Just to me was like, oh, we're doing this. Okay.
Yeah, I was not thinking about that while watching the movie because I didn't really know this story.
You know, plus the fact, the thing I didn't know that has resurfaced of late is Tarantino's defense of Polanski on the Howard Stern show.
I didn't know about that either.
Which is like,
you just told me about that.
Yeah. So
anyway, my overall read on this film is, yeah, it's about these guys.
Mm-hmm.
But there is so much going on in this movie that involves the act of watching. It's about how we see film. It's about how we see television. It's about how we watch actors.
Yeah.
It's about
how actors watch themselves.
How actors watch themselves. It's about how actors watch the world. One of the more interesting characters in the film is that short little moment with Julia Butters, who plays Anna Catt on American Housewife, one of the children. She's a child actor working opposite DiCaprio on this TV show. And she is
focused.
She is Dakota Fanning, who is also in this film as Squeaky Fromm.
Yes.
The woman who would eventually try to assassinate Gerald Ford.
Although I think in a historical context, she is Pamela Ferdin.
But we don't know enough about Pamela Ferdin at that time in her life or what kind of person, what kind of actor she was perceived to be.
Well,
from the moment Dakota Fanning showed up.
True.
In I Am Sam, as a 6-year-old, she turned your head because she came off as
a 20-year-old.
unnaturally poised and intelligent and focused and intuitive kid actor. That it was a little freaky to watch her exist because from movie to movie to movie to movie, you would think, how old are you? Why are you? You look like an adult, but you're acting like someone who's already 35. Like, it's so weird to watch that rare child that is that way. And Leonardo DiCaprio even says to her character, what are you, 12? And she says, I'm 8. And I don't like your tone. Like, that's, she speaks to him this way.
Yes.
And so there's the element of that. I think it's about how other actors watch their own careers and the careers of others, how they strive, how they climb, how they fail, how they resent the process, how they destroy themselves, how they possibly destroy others.
But given the shot at redemption that he gets at the end of this movie, ultimately, what I feel a lot of what Tarantino is saying is like, wouldn't it be great if these has-beens never had to be has-beens?
I think that's a separate issue than what I'm talking about.
Okay.
What I'm talking about is what, and I guess one of the Manson women at the end says it very explicitly. Mm. We've grown up watching this stuff, and now we are going to be the thing that we have watched.
Right. They showed us how to kill.
They showed us how to kill. Now we're going to kill. Yeah. But DiCaprio watches himself on TV constantly. Mm-hmm. The Manson people are watching TV all the time. They talk about the TV shows they love to watch. Yeah. They get excited when they find out that one of their favorite TV stars just shouted at them.
Yes.
The bus, Sharon Tate,
all the bus benches in Los Angeles are advertising local television
programs. Yes. Sharon Tate watches herself. She watches other people watching her in the movie. And what I think that means is that all this media that we see and internalize over the course of our lives builds up in us a sense of who we are and how we are in relationship to each other and to actors. Actors inform so much of what we think about the world.
And also, like, and fiction informs so much of what we think about actors. It's like what Pacino's character says to DiCaprio, that after a while, people aren't seeing you play a character. They're watching Rick Dalton get his butt kicked every week. And so, so much of what we know about, or what we think we know about actors, is based on what we've seen them play. And so, you know, like, we don't know. What we know about Sharon Tate, for the most part, is thinking of her in movies like Valley of the Dolls, where she was this sort of beautiful, innocent, you know, exploited creature. You know, what we think about the many actors that DiCaprio is standing in for here is these sort of, like, tough loners, when maybe off-screen they were, you know, alcoholics with low self-esteem.
Right. So it becomes this thing where, you know, we don't question who they really are.
Right.
We don't question that. We simply think of them as special people that do a special thing that very few people do. Sintra Wilson once said that the number of famous people in the world is statistically insignificant. They do not exist in terms of statistical significance. That's how few of them there are.
Yes.
Even though now there are more than ever, but like they are a microscopic blip. And so we take them and we give them the power to guide us through so much of life, which is why we get excited when we see them.
Right.
We personalize them. Mm-hmm. And if we do get to talk to them, we get tongue-tied. The first time I ever met a famous person not in the service of work, but at a party, and I had to talk to this person. The person said to me, so what do you do? And I said, I do blah, blah, blah. And then I didn't have a thing to ask this person because I already knew so much about them. I already knew what they did for a living. And when I got tongue-tied and stammered, that person turned and walked away and went to get a drink. And I was like, oh, good, I'm glad that's over. Like, I was so happy to not be there anymore in the moment. But our fantasy life intrudes on real life.
Right.
We don't know what to do with that. And that's, I think, part of what this movie is about.
You know, I think we'll be unpacking a lot of what this movie is about. And I think we'll also be unpacking, you know, what we find, you know,
Oh, and by the
what we take
way,
issue with.
Clu Gulager. Old, he's in his 90s now. Old
Wow.
character actor,
Yes.
frequent patron of the New
The New
Beverly
Beverly
Cinema.
Cinema.
You go there to see a movie, he's probably there to watch it with you.
Yes.
He was on a show in the late 50s that starred Steve McQueen. The name of that show was Wanted Dead or Alive. Steve McQueen played a bounty hunter. Clu Gulager was on that show at least once as a guest star. That's the show that Leonardo DiCaprio is in. It's called Bounty Law in the film.
And
This is literally the show.
Steve McQueen does pop up as a character here, which Nathan Rabe referred to as Ugly Steve
Ugly Steve McQueen. Yeah.
McQueen.
Why you cast Damian Lewis as Steve McQueen? He doesn't look like Steve McQueen at all.
Yeah, that's a bit crazy.
Yeah.
No, Clu Gulager loves him an old movie because
All of them.
because like not just at the New Beverly, I will never forget one of the times that we saw Playtime at the Egyptian in 70 millimeter. We're standing in a circle with our friends chatting, and I feel a hand clap me on my shoulder, and a guy says, "Wasn't that something?" And I turn, and it's Clu Gulager. And I go, yeah, it was. And he walks on. I'm like,
Have a good night,
"What just
Clu
happened?"
Gulager. Anyway, he's also in
He
this
pops
film.
up in this movie, yes, as do a lot
As
of.
do all everyone.
Tarantino has a section of the credits that's just called The Gang, and it's, you know, his repertory company, if you will.
Of 75-year-old men.
Yes, and Zoe Bell.
And Zoe Bell.
So yeah, we would love to hear your thoughts about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. You can leave a comment on our Patreon page or drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Oh, I didn't do the whole spiel before we got into spoilers. Anyway, we're at LinoleumCast on
You
Twitter,
got to go to
Instagram,
work
and
too, so
Facebook.
save
I
that for
know
the
I got to
next one.
scoot. At LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Leave us a positive review at Apple Podcasts. Have a nice day. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.